Today is Monday, May 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Speaker of Iran's parliament says that international inspectors may no longer access surveillance images of its nuclear sites.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has said its director general will brief reporters in Vienna.
Plus, local media reports that fighters opposed to Myanmar's military junta battle troops in the country's east. And after a year's hiatus, the Eurovision Song Competition has a winner. We'll have these stories and more next. The Speaker of Iran's parliament says that international inspectors may no longer access surveillance images of the Islamic Republic's nuclear sites. Associated Press correspondent Zaria Shackley reports his comments are escalating tensions amid diplomatic efforts in Vienna to save Tehran's atomic accord with world powers.
The comments by Iran's parliament speaker, aired by state TV, further underscored the narrowing window for the U.S. and others to reach terms with Iran. The Islamic Republic is already enriching and stockpiling uranium at levels far beyond those allowed by its 2015 nuclear deal. The International Atomic Energy Agency has said its director general will brief reporters in Vienna. The United Nations agency did not immediately respond to a request for comment. I'm Zaria Shackley.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, is in talks with Iran on extending the accord. The IAEA had planned for Grossi to hold a news conference on Sunday, but it said that he is still consulting with Tehran and that his news conference had been postponed until Monday morning. Local media reports that fighters opposed to Myanmar's military junta fought with troops in the country's east Sunday and claimed to have killed more than 10 members of the security forces and destroyed a police station. I spoke with reporter Cape Diamond in Yangon to get the details.
We are hearing the continuous explosion and, of course, the shootings in different cities and different states in the country. And the last one is the one that in Mopier, which is in southern Shan State, and which is, of course, in between the Shan State and Gaya State. So the local defense force, we call it people defense force. And according to the local media report, 15 members of the troops killed and the four captured alive by the local force. At the same time, you know, not only in that region, but also in the other different area of the country is having the fighting between the people defense force and the state administration council, the military troops. And they have seized, you know, a bunch of the weapon as well, according to the local report.
Cape, as you mentioned, these are local reports based on information from the People's Defense Forces and other groups. What has the military junta said in response to these latest reports?
Well, so far as we know, that there has been no response, like official response from the junta on these specific cases on their state media. You know, they have been spreading the news about the the cases that they have been detained, and mostly the ones that, you know, they detained for relating to the explosion cases in the cities like Yangon and Mandalay. So, but in terms of this specific case, we don't really see any response from the junta yet.
Cape, I wanted to switch gears for just a second. Over the weekend, the military junta said that it is considering revoking the registration of the National League for Democracy Party, the party of Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint, because of what the junta alleges is voting fraud during last year's contest. Have they been able to produce proof to support their allegations?
They said, you know, they have found the election fraud, and they have a number of the cases that, you know, being allegedly accused the National League for Democracy, is cheating, you know, the election, and they have been, you know, announcing their own results, what they have based on what they have found. But what they have found are not being independently confirmed by the, you know, independent organization or the independent, you know, election observer.
Cape Diamond reports from Yangon, Myanmar. Thousands of people in the Democratic Republic of Congo fled their homes to escape lava flows from an erupting volcano near Goma. While most of the city was spared, those who returned to the outskirts of Goma Sunday found that their homes had been destroyed. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Early Sunday, a group of men tried without success to redirect the flow of lava coming from Congo's Mount Nyiragongo. The government there announced an evacuation plan, but it came hours after the sky turned red and thousands had already fled. The Goma Volcanology Observatory had warned days earlier of increased seismic activity. By morning, evacuees began the long journey home to find what was left of their homes after Nyiragongo's first eruption in almost two decades. Area resident Masika Muguiko says the hardship continues.
We have suffered too much. We walked about 15 kilometers and now we have just walked back. When we arrived, our houses were burned or destroyed and everything was stolen.
Nearly 2 million people live within range of Nyiragongo in the city of Goma. Officials in neighboring Rwanda say more than 8,000 Congolese people fled across the border to escape the lava flows. Now, as they return to Congo, only uncertainty awaits.
Now I don't know where to go. I'm only walking in the street, and we are afraid because the fire is still visible in the lava.
Meanwhile, reports said Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi was cutting short a trip to Europe and returning home to help coordinate relief efforts. This was Mount Nyiragongo's third major eruption since 1977. The city of Goma, near the mountain's base, is eastern Congo's hub of trade and transport, humanitarian aid, and a base for a UN peacekeeping mission called MONUSCO. Local officials say only a handful of people died and blamed the deaths on accidents during evacuation. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. UN officials expressed concern Sunday at the scale of destruction in Gaza following the ceasefire that ended the latest round of fighting between Israel and the militant group Hamas. On Saturday, the UN Security Council stressed the immediate need for humanitarian assistance to the Palestinian civilian population. And reporter Hin Kunduri, who reports on Gaza, told me the first deliveries of aid have arrived.
There were medical, financial, and health aids, and this was the first time Gaza received any type of help since the beginning of the ceasefire agreement. It was from Egypt, but when we come and talk about humanitarian situation in Gaza, there are at least 40,000 Palestinians that are homeless right now in UNRWA schools because they lost their houses, where at least 16,800 housing units were affected until the ceasefire agreement was done. 800 houses were severely damaged and are uninhabitable for people to live. We are also talking about infrastructure and water. The UN reported yesterday that 50% of the Palestinians can't reach healthy drinkable water. And this means that Gaza is witnessing a very collapsing situation. The situation is devastating and it is on the verge of collapse.
Hind, I want to ask you about what people are saying about the next few days, weeks, perhaps even months. Aid's now trickling in, but there has been that call for more aid to arrive to help those people in need. But the ceasefire has only been brokered for a few days now. Is there concern that fighting could resume?
Talking to a lot of Palestinians in Gaza about the ceasefire, people believe that this ceasefire is very fragile. And this is because there were no agreements put on the ground. This is because it's totally related to Jerusalem and Sheikh Jarrah, and violence is still going on in Al-Aqsa and Sheikh Jarrah. So Palestinians, after the ceasefire agreement, did celebrate because they're still alive, they're still breathing, and this is what made them celebrate. This is very fragile. Violence is expected to take place in any minute. Palestinians don't really trust what the Israeli forces release and report. But at the same time, Palestinians also said that if anything happens or if the violence escalates in Jerusalem, they won't stand silent.
Hind Kunduri spoke to me from Istanbul. Egyptian mediators have been shuttling between Israel and the Gaza Strip, which is ruled by Hamas, to try to sustain the ceasefire. They've also met with the Islamist group's rival, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, in the occupied West Bank. Jordan's King Abdullah stressed on Sunday the importance of translating the Gaza ceasefire into an extended truce and said that there is no alternative to a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians. Now, to discuss what impact the latest fighting may have on that process, I spoke with James Jeffrey, chair of the Middle East program at the Wilson Center in Washington. He's also a former ambassador to Iraq and Turkey and special envoy to the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS.
First of all, it is very difficult to predict how things go in the Middle East. Nobody saw this coming. On the other hand, we have seen so many similar flare-ups in the past that have not resulted either in a descent into war and chaos on the one hand, nor into a true movement towards a final and resilient peace on the other, that the likelihood is both sides will decide that they won a limited victory. Hamas, by expanding its claim to represent all Palestinians, not just those in Gaza, by supporting the action against Israel in Jerusalem, and also the rioting by Israeli Arabs during the conflict, and also by not overwhelming but penetrating Israel's famed Iron Dome air defense system. Israel, on the other hand, did manage to shoot down the vast majority of Hamas rockets, and it inflicted extraordinarily significant damage to the Hamas leadership structure, the tunnel structure, and their rockets, and also demonstrated a fearsome control of, if you will, the intelligence scenario for Gaza that has really knocked the Hamas people back. So for the moment, both sides, I think, will lick their wounds and see what advantage they can get from this. But there's no telling where it will go.
What about relations with Israel and other Arab nations? You know, we saw the UAE, Bahrain, and other countries start to normalize relations and recognize Israel. And that met with some resistance from some Arab nations, some Palestinians. Based on this latest, you know, fighting situation, what kind of impact do you think will that have on the overall Abraham Accords and relations in the region?
No, I think one of the reasons that the Israelis were pretty happy with the state of play and thus went along with the pressure by President Biden and the negotiations by the Egyptians is that they were pretty happy with the reaction of the Arab states. Obviously, the Arab states are not going to sit on their hands when Israel is doing things that are objectionable, as they are, without question, to Arabs in Jerusalem at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But there wasn't a particularly strong or dramatic reaction by the Emiratis or Saudis or others. There was criticism of Israel, but by the standards of the Middle East, it was limited. And, of course, Egypt played a balancing role. We have to remember that most of these states, beginning with Egypt, see Hamas, which is a manifestation of the regional Islamic movement, as an enemy more to be feared than Israel. So I think that Israel has basically managed to preserve the Abraham Accords and, interestingly, also a closer and better relationship, ironically, with the United States.
Ambassador James Jeffrey is the chair of the Middle East program at the Wilson Center in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden cited his administration's quiet, relentless diplomacy in helping to broker a ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports on what role the United States will likely play going forward to facilitate a lasting peace.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Friday that Israel accomplished with outstanding success the goals of its Gaza campaign to deliver a harsh blow to terror organizations and diminish their capabilities. U.S. President Joe Biden welcomed the ceasefire and thanked Egypt for helping to broker it. President Joe Biden:
I believe the Palestinians and Israelis equally deserve to live safely and securely and to enjoy equal measures of freedom, prosperity, and democracy. My administration will continue our quiet, relentless diplomacy toward that end. I believe we have a genuine opportunity to make progress, and I'm committed to working for it.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also welcomed the ceasefire and called on both sides to adhere to it. In northern Gaza, families returned to their homes Friday to survey the damage. Experts say Gaza will need the help of the United States and other countries to rebuild after massive destruction of an already poor area. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he will travel to the region soon. Lucy Kortza Ellenbogen is with the United States Institute of Peace.
So I think for Secretary Blinken, there's going to be an effort to obviously engage with the parties, the Israelis and the Palestinians. And by the Palestinians here, we mean the Palestinian Authority. It would be very important, I think, for the U.S. administration to re-engage and re-embolden, if you will, re-empower President Mahmoud Abbas, who has been largely silent and out of the picture here as the extremists and as Hamas on the Palestinian side has absorbed the narrative.
Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A prominent opponent of Belarus's president was arrested on Sunday after an airliner on which he was traveling was diverted to the country after a bomb threat. The opposition is calling the action a hijacking operation by the government. Authorities say President Alexander Lukashenko personally ordered that a MiG-29 fighter jet accompany the Ryanair plane, which was traveling from Athens, Greece, to Vilnius, Lithuania, to the airport Sunday in the capital of Minsk. A Belarusian deputy Air Force commander said that the plane's crew made the decision to land in Minsk, but Ryanair said that Belarusian air traffic control instructed the plane to divert to the capital. The Belarusian Interior Ministry said Roman Protasevich was arrested at the airport. Protasevich is the co-founder of the Telegram messaging app's Next Channel. Belarus last year declared it extremist after it was used to help organize major protests against Lukashenko. Protasevich, who had fled the country for Poland, faces charges that could carry a prison sentence of up to 15 years.
This is Science in a Minute.
Fast radio bursts are incredibly powerful, but short pulses of radio energy that last from 1 to several milliseconds. Because they're so short and can originate at any time from anywhere far across the universe, scientists have had difficulty detecting them. Despite these problems, astronomers have been able to trace the source of several FRBs. Scientists using NASA's Hubble Space Telescope have recently traced the origin of 5 FRBs to the spiral arm of 5 distant and massive galaxies. While astronomers don't know what causes FRBs, several theories suggest possible triggers. Scientists involved with the Hubble research suggest their findings support a popular notion that FRBs are generated by outbursts from magnetars, a type of neutron star with powerful magnetic fields. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. At least 13 people died and 3 were seriously injured on Sunday when an Italian cable car plunged some 20 meters to the ground. Reuters' Soroya Ali has the details.
More than a dozen people died and at least 3 were seriously injured in Italy on Sunday when a cable car linking Lake Maggiore with a nearby mountain in the Alps plunged to the ground. The Stresa Matarone cable car carries tourists and local people from the town of Stresa, almost 1,400 meters above sea level, to the top of Matarone Mountain. Marcella Severino, Stresa's mayor, told a national broadcaster that the accident happened as the cable car was traveling up the mountain. The cabin dropped some 20 meters and rolled several times down the steep slopes before it was stopped by trees. Coroners had started identifying the victims, who included foreign nationals, she said, without giving further details. A spokesperson for Italy's Alpine Rescue Service told a local broadcaster that two children had been transported by helicopter to a pediatric hospital in the nearby northern city of Turin. The Stresa Matarone lift had only recently reopened following the gradual lifting of coronavirus restrictions. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi voiced his condolences to the families of the victims with a special thought for the wounded children.
Saroya Ali reports for Reuters News. Ending the COVID-19 pandemic and preventing future pandemics is expected to dominate discussions during this week's 74th World Health Assembly. That's the decision-making body of the World Health Organization. The session will also address other pressing global health issues. And Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
The 2021 World Health Assembly will be held virtually from May 24th through June 1st. This, in and of itself, is aimed at sending a strong message that it still is not safe for large groups of people to gather physically. More than 2,750 people so far have registered to attend the virtual event. WHO declared the COVID-19 outbreak a pandemic and a global international public health emergency on March 11th, 2020. Since then, COVID-19 cases have increased 40-fold to 162 million, including more than 3.3 million deaths. Discussions on a so-called pandemic treaty to better prepare for and prevent global infectious outbreaks is expected to take center stage at the Global Assembly. WHO Chief Legal Officer Stephen Solomon says drafting a treaty would be a long process. He says delegates have not decided whether negotiations on a treaty should be started. He says a legally binding pandemic convention would cover both substantive issues, which include equitable sharing of materials, such as vaccines and diagnoses, and structural ones.
Structurally, you know, the elements that often comes up is issues of enforcement mechanisms, compliance mechanisms, monitoring mechanisms, incentives and disincentives. There's clearly issues of governance and how that would work under treaty institutions of financing.
The assembly will face the largest agenda ever over the coming 8 days, with more than 72 global health issues under examination. Questions of vaccine equity will be central to these discussions. Wealthy countries are making great strides in vaccinating their populations and returning to a semblance of normal life, but poor countries are not. WHO warns vaccine inequity threatens ending the pandemic and global recovery from the pandemic. As in previous years, the issue of granting Taiwan observer status at the WHA will come up for debate at the opening session. China claims Taiwan is one of its provinces and has blocked Taiwan's participation since 2016. Under Beijing's One China policy, the Chinese Communist Party asserts sovereignty over Taiwan. This year, 13 WHO member states, including the United States, have called for Taiwan to be allowed to take part in proceedings. They say Taiwan has great insight on tackling the pandemic and would have a lot to contribute. Other significant issues to be addressed include the eradication of polio, speeding action on antimicrobial resistance, and considering WHO's global strategy on health, environment, and climate change. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advisory group says some teenagers and young adults who receive COVID-19 vaccines have experienced heart inflammation and are recommending further study of the rare condition. Brian Wood from Reuters reports.
A statement dated May 17th from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said some teens and young adults, mostly male, had developed an inflammation of the heart muscle called myocarditis after receiving their vaccine. The CDC added that the condition often goes away on its own, and the number of cases so far have not been cause for major concern. They did not say how many people had been affected, but said cases typically occurred within 4 days after receiving mRNA vaccines without specific specifying which ones. In April, Israel's health ministry started examining similar cases tied to Pfizer's vaccine. It is yet to draw any conclusions. Neither Pfizer nor Moderna responded immediately to requests for comment on Saturday.
Reuters' Brian Wood. Vietnamese-American Danielle Ngo doesn't remember much about her escape from Vietnam. She was just 3 years old when she fled Saigon on one of the last American planes to take off before North Vietnamese troops took over the city. Ngo has since dedicated more than three decades of her life to the United States Army, giving back, she says, to the country that saved her. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has her story.
At 5'2", Colonel Danielle Ngo might not look like it, but she is a force of nature. She's beaten back wildfires, helped capture Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and jumped out of planes.
I always wanted to jump out of perfectly good aircraft, so I always wanted to be a paratrooper.
Ngo has paved the way for Asian Americans as the highest active duty woman of Vietnamese descent in the U.S. Army.
We are proud of what she does.
She currently serves as the executive officer for the Army's Inspector General, Lieutenant General Leslie Smith.
She's the enforcer.
I make things happen behind
the scenes. Make things happen, right. Really, not just for the 200 people that are here, but those additional 1,400 inspectors generals that support commanders out in the field.
Ngo's grandmother worked at the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. So in 1975, when the Vietnam War was ending, Ngo fled to the Saigon airport with her mother and younger sister as the North Vietnamese bombed the city.
The ceiling was crumbling and it was falling down because the airport was under attack.
U.S. personnel rushed her family onto a plane waiting to take off.
It was too heavy and they had to get more people on, so they actually took equipment and threw it off the plane. The Army had rescued us at the end of the war, and so I knew that I wanted to give something back.
So when Ngo turned 17, she wanted to enlist.
I went to my mother and she said, no way. I was 17, I had to get her approval and her signature because I was underage. She said, I did not take you from a war for you to go back into a war.
Eventually, she convinced her mother to let her join, and she has not looked back, paving the way for other military women.
Females weren't allowed in the combat unit. And I remember begging, please, send me to one of the two combat battalions and give me a shot.
The Army gave in as an experiment, she says, and she started jumping out of aircraft with her unit.
Then I found out I was pregnant with my first child, and I was like, oh no, I gotta get into Jet Master School. So I didn't let anybody know that I was pregnant.
She jumped out of aircraft three times while pregnant before admitting it was too risky.
Should never have done that. But it was just the mindset at the time. And that's why I tell my story to other females, because they need to know that some of the things I did, they don't need to do anymore. Because it is, women are so much more accepted now.
Ngo eventually worked her way into a combat engineering post, a mostly male occupation. And after decades of demolitions, Ngo's combat engineering prowess has earned a nod from national engineering organization Discover E.
I'm getting recognized as an engineer, the one branch that I wanted because I thought it was the toughest branch at the time that you could be in for a female.
Now, this trailblazer is adding Asian American Engineer of the Year to her lifetime of accomplishments. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
And finally, after a year hiatus due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Eurovision Song Contest roared back to life in the Netherlands for its 65th iteration. The event saw entrants from 39 countries perform in hopes of bringing back not only the coveted Eurovision trophy, but the rights to host the contest next year. And while all the artists want to rise up to the top spot, there can only be one winner. And this year, it was Italy's glam rock band Maneskin. The group's bassist, Victoria De Angelis.
It's just so important for us that it's coming to Italy, because that's, we think it could be like a message of hope because of this hard year we've been through.
Maneskin's rock song is unlike the kitschy pop Eurovision is known for, but was the favorite with bookmakers as well as fans before the contest. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.